When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 541 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast presented by Overdrive. This is Adam, joined by Jill. Jill, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. For everyone listening, I'm in the office today and we have a weird different microphone setup. So if it sounds a little bit different than normal with my voice, that's why. So yeah, just a heads up. This might happen a few times in the coming months as we readjust to life, both in and out of our office. So also rude Cleveland and Northeast Ohio. We got a end of April snowstorm. That's not very nice. Don't appreciate that. But okay. Do you want to kind of, I don't know, we don't really have like a one theme. We have like five things we're going to talk about. Do you want to kind of set like a framework for what we're going to talk about today? Because people seem to like when we talk about things that aren't always directly just book recommendations. So buckle up.
Yeah. So are we naming, is this episode titled Authors Behaving Badly?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with that. It's okay. Just fun. It's a fun title.
So based on that, for those of you who are listening and saw the title of the episode, so over the past, well, a while now, but it, specifically this was sort of the catalyst for this was over the weekend there was an author who not losing talking well of reviewers. despite the fact that those reviewers gave positive reviews, it was a whole thing. And then when called out on the fact that, you know, publicly calling out reviews, good or bad, but you really shouldn't call out reviewers regardless, but publicly calling out good reviews and treating them as bad, when called out on that, they started doubling down and then tripling down, and it just kept going and is probably still going. And this is just sort of like a thing that happens sometimes where authors read reviews and criticism and respond terribly.
Yeah, so we're gonna kind of get into like just all of the things that might happen online pertaining to authors and our responses as readers and suggested responses for you guys. And then we have like some specific examples of things that have happened, and other ones we'll be more vague about just because if you listen to this, you're probably in the literary world and you either are super aware of what we're talking about, or maybe you like blissfully don't know what we're talking about. And I don't want to ruin that version. Fair. Either.
Well, that's fair. I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah. Like if you, the author from this weekend, their book has been getting good reviews. They've been doing a whole bunch of media stuff, and it is entirely possible that you liked their book. And I don't want to like, ruin that for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the first things we want to get into is the concept of like understanding just the whole, like not even cottage industry, it's like industry of online reviews of books. Because there's a lot of things to get into about it. First off, online reviews are very important for authors. It drives sales, their Amazon rankings, their Goodreads rankings, places that are problematic for their own reasons. I think Reading Glasses did a podcast all about the problematic aspects of that. And we won't, there's so much to that. But it is true that online reviews are important for authors. So just as like a first statement, if you like a book and you love an author, definitely go leave them a 5-star review and write something.
No authors owed a 5-star review.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
That is like the catalyst. Like that is what started this whole thing off. Yeah, is that right. someone did not receive a 5-star review and was talking shit about reviewers who gave them 4 stars.
Absolutely.
No authors owed a 5-star review. Review them whatever you think is fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And so my whole part was like, if you want to leave a positive review for someone that you like to help out their ability to keep supporting themselves as an author, that's great. But you're absolutely right. And along those lines, just taking reviews with a grain of salt. Do you want to talk about the like kind of review bombing thing and like,
Okay. So this happens also. Goodreads is, you know, I think what happens is sometimes if you are involved in the book Twitter world, book Twitter and like Goodreads kind of go hand in hand and sometimes exist in a vacuum. So, you know, if you're just like a casual user of Goodreads, you may have no idea that this happens, especially if you're not on Twitter and in book Twitter. But what will happen is that an author will behave badly in whatever way that means. And then people in response will start essentially like review bombing their book or books and just start giving it 1 stars across the board, like regardless of if they've read it or what. And so it dramatically will bring somebody's Goodreads score down. If there are 2 authors at it, which sometimes happens as well, their individual fans will go after the other author. Well, then they'll bring up the other ones. I mean, like it's a big fluctuating mess. So, if you're on Goodreads and looking at book reviews and ratings, just, you know, do some, you know, if you're like, you're interested in a book, it sounds good to you, and then it has like a terrible rating, you know, maybe do some legwork and actually investigate and see where that comes from. Like, you can tell when reviews were left or ratings were left. And, you know, all books are going to get 5 stars. Things will get 5 stars. Things will get 1 star. And, you know, if they're like spread out evenly over the course of several weeks or months or whatever, those are probably genuinely 5-star, 1-star reviews where the reviewer did not love the book. If an author all of a sudden has like hundreds of 1-star reviews in the span of 4 days, maybe consider where those came from and if they're actually genuine, you know. And like sometimes, and don't even like, just don't eat, like the stars serve one purpose, but the actual reviews, if you read those, will probably give you the information you need. Like, I look for like those 3- and 4-star reviews, and sometimes the 2s too. Like, I feel like, don't even consider the 5 and 1 stars, because I feel like those are just too far end of the spectrum, because the majority of books are not going to be either 5 or 1 star. Like, you know what I mean? Like, for me personally.
Yeah.
No. It's all going to be in those 2 to 4. And like reviews are helpful. And this is a reminder that reviews are for readers, not authors.
Yeah. And exactly what you said is such a good point. Like, something, do some research, because I know that sometimes you just want to be told really quickly, like, here's a great book to read, and you just want to go borrow it. And like, hey, hi, that's what we're here for. Thanks for subscribing and listening to our podcast. We do that once a week normally. But if you're going to base your book purchasing, book borrowing, book recommending to someone else, that based on reviews and things, like, take the time to go through and read them, because you're going to spend 5, 10, 20 hours with this book. Take 30 minutes to read through those reviews and say like, oh, okay, here is why they're saying whatever they say. Cause like you said, try not to pay attention to the stars, because like Jill and I might both adore a book and I might give it 4 stars and she might give it 3 stars. That doesn't mean my review is bad. Like, we could write the exact same review and just in our brains might think of stars differently.
Correct.
You know? So yeah, huge grain of salt.
Also, Goodreads is not the end.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. There are lots of places. There are reviews. Like, you can get star ratings in the Libby app on books. Like, people, you know, so if there's a book, you can maybe find it the star rating of readers in the Libby app or Amazon. I mean, I think Goodreads is just the easiest, the fastest, and it's the one that people, especially book bloggers, tend to use the most. And so I think that's why they use that as the platform, as a way of sort of like weaponizing reviews against authors, rightly or wrongly. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of places you can get book reviews. It's not just Goodreads.
Yeah. And that's something I will say, like, over this year, especially, I've gotten off Goodreads and I've been using the Storygraph. And this isn't like, they're not a partner of us. They're not sponsored by, we're not sponsored by them or anything. I just happen to really like the service. And one of the things I enjoy about it is that, yes, you can leave star reviews, and yes, you can absolutely leave longer, you know, more thought out word reviews, but they also have these, they provide much more context to what the book, what people who have read the book consider about the book. So when you review a book there, yes, it'll ask you to put a star rating at the very end, and it'll ask if you want to write more, but they have all of these different check boxes. And it says, you know, basically it's like, what moods did this book convey? And it's like, is it emotional, reflective, hopeful, sad, mysterious, inspiring, lighthearted, relaxing, adventurous, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of them. It also asks you what pace you thought the book was. And then it asks some interesting questions like, would you think the book was plot or character driven or a mix, or this isn't applicable? Did you find the characters lovable? Did you find that there was a strong, diverse cast? Was there character development? Like, and it kind of asks these pointed questions where you can not answer them, or you can say it's complicated. And it that way, when you look at a book, it kind of, without casting like a huge judgmental, like, this book was, you know, the worst thing of all time, it lets you get an idea of like what style of the book it is. And that's been really helpful for me to look at a description of a book, which admittedly also, like, publishers are trying to sell a book, so they're always going to tell you, this book is a perfect mix of The Hunger Games and Divergent. It's like, oh, really? It's a mix of two of the biggest YA series of the last decade. Like, it's their job to hook you. But like, reading the description and then also looking at the Storygraph stuff about like what other readers have thought about the mood has helped me find titles that I've enjoyed better. So that's, again, they're not a sponsor or anything. I just like the Storygraph. I think that's a decent way of doing it. Or you can always, you know, ask librarians or friends whose literary thoughts you respect. There's lots of podcasts like ours, but yeah. Do you have more thoughts on reviews?
I do actually. It should be pointed out, I think, you know, one of the problems that comes with this is that, especially if it is an author with a very large following, going after book bloggers, you know, like we do this podcast as part of our job, right? Like, we're paid for this essentially. Yeah. Most book bloggers do it for free because mm-hmm. they love books and it's a hobby. And it's a lot of thankless work for the book bloggers and reviewers, whether it's on YouTube, whether it is a blog, whether they're doing it just on Goodreads, wherever, Edelweiss, mm-hmm. wherever. They're usually small. They don't have the platform and the base that a large author might have. And so when authors sort of start calling out reviewers, it puts reviewers in really, really bad positions. And you can find stories of authors who have like physically shown up at a reviewer's home mm-hmm. because of a review.
Yeah.
And, you know, like finding where they are. I know after this weekend, a lot of reviewers went on lockdown on their social media or left social media altogether because it's not always safe for them, which is just ridiculous. It's a mm-hmm. book review. Like, yeah. I mean, oh my God, it's just,
I love exactly what you said though, because like for every big YouTube book blogger, like Christine Riccio, who came on the podcast a couple years ago, and she's lovely and she's wonderful and people adore her. She has like 500,000 followers on YouTube. If she leaves a negative review and someone tries to like come after her, she has the resources to take care of herself, to be like, this is how I feel. And here's like, she probably at this point, she is also an author. I'm sure she has a lawyer that can help that with that kind of stuff. But exactly what you said, like most of those, I love her reviews, but I've also discovered reviewers on YouTube that have like 200 followers. And I'm like, wow, they are fabulous. And I love everything about them. And I am going to read this book because of them. Like, and those people are just as likely to get called out by an author who's spending too much time on Goodreads than
probably more likely because they don't have the backing, you know, behind them to be able to fight back. And so it is just ridiculous the way some authors go after reviewers. I mean, but I'm not kidding about that physically showing up at reviewers' house things either. Yeah. I'm not joking about that. And it's not just a one-time deal. Like, I can think of two instances where authors have shown up at a reviewer's home. One of them got a second book deal out of it. So
there's been a lot of things in the news this week about people getting book deals out of committing horrible acts of insanity. Okay, so this kind of transitions to a question that we wanted to address is, what do you do about authors who maybe you've liked their books in the past and it turns out that they're not so great? So we're just, to be frank, Jill and I have interviewed people that we enjoyed and we liked. There's one somewhat local to us whose name I won't bring up because it's very local to us, who was on the podcast, and we spoke glowingly about her for like a year and a half, 2 years. And it turns out she's kind of awful, apparently, in private life. And so what do we do about that? Like, what are your thoughts? What do we do when people turn out to be kind of terrible, maybe?
Yeah, that's a hard one. And I feel like, I think everyone has to kind of decide their own limit, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're going to talk about, we don't want to name names, but I will say J.K. Rowling, like, come on. So like, that's sort of that's the very low hanging fruit, but you know, we are big Harry Potter fans. Mm-hmm. We have talked at length. We did dedicated episodes to individual books, way back when the illustrated ones were coming out, and I still have my books. Mm-hmm. They're sitting on my bookshelf. I'm not buying anymore. Like, you know what I mean? And so like, there is a line where I'm willing to draw, where I can say, you know, these books represented a particular part of my life. They mm-hmm. still mean a lot to me. She's not getting more money from me.
Yeah. And that's,
and like, that is the line I'm willing to draw. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, if you want to get rid of your books, that is entirely fine too. Like, I think that's one of those things where everyone has to decide for themselves what their limit is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's such a perfect way of saying it. I mean, to your point, I literally have people who have followed us on Instagram for a while, I'm sure have seen, I have Harry Potter tattoos on my left forearm. Like, there's no hiding them. If I wore a t-shirt, you can see 7 different Harry Potter related images on my left forearm. I obviously got them before it turned out that J.K. Rowling, you know, was transphobic and, you know, basically denying trans people's rights to exist. And she, you know, we obviously don't support that. We've done episodes of books by trans authors. And Jill, I mean, if you're just now discovering that Jill and I are all about equality, hi, welcome to our podcast. We are very open about that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, I'm much with you. Like, I have all my copies of the books and everything. I'm not going to purchase anymore, but I also am not going to feel sad or ashamed that those books were a huge formative aspect of my life. I mean, there's an entire, I don't even want to say one generation. There's several generations of people where like Harry Potter is the equivalent to, you know, Star Wars and Lord of the Rings to it, and to an extent for, you know, those before us. And even still, like, it's one of those cultural touchstones. And the same thing I think goes to a lesser extent to authors who you've read their books. Well, for us, you've had conversations with them, and then it turns out that, you know, they're not great. Like, those people aren't going to get any more of my money, but I'm also not going to feel bad about reading a book that I liked in the moment. Like, don't, the life's too short to feel bad about books you actually enjoyed in the past.
Yeah.
So, and the one thing about that is it's very easy. Like, Jill, like you were talking about at the beginning, the person who is talking over the weekend has like doubled, tripled, and quadrupled down on being kind of awful about reviewers. There, you know, everyone in Fox News likes to say the words cancel culture and just like use it as a talking point. But like the fact that people are very quick on social media to say like, this person's horrible, let's move on, forget about them forever. Like, that's totally fair. And sometimes, but there are also instances where people do make a mistake and then they're contrite about it. And this one, we will name names because there's two people that I think deserve attention for being on either side of this. One, from a negative standpoint, is there's an author named Lindsay Ellis, who she's a video essayist, I think.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah. She has created a very large following on YouTube by creating these admittedly very interesting essays, usually about pop culture and Broadway shows and movies. And I think that's like what her background is. Mm-hmm. It's basically like movie, like film analysis kind of a situation. And she's literally, I follow her on YouTube. I followed her for a long time. I really enjoyed her like hour and a half breakdowns of Phantom of the Opera and different stuff. But so Lindsay Ellis went on Twitter and said this thing about Raya and the Last Dragon, about how it reminded her basically of, like, I'm just going to broad strokes this because I don't feel like going into her whole thing.
No, I mean, I think, no, because the exact example she used was relevant to the conversation. She basically said that Ryan was like Avatar The Last Airbender, and like, that's all that Asian stories are just redoings of Avatar The Last Airbender.
Yeah,
that was her whole argument, which is problematic for several reasons. The first being that Avatar The Last Airbender was created by white people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people, as you can imagine, respond and were like, what are you talking about? This is awful. And in response to this, instead of being like, here's the error of my ways, Lindsay Ellis just got off Twitter. She just deleted her account. And then several weeks later, as she's prone to do, she made a video essay about cancel culture, and it clocks in at just under 2 hours. It's a feature-length film-length YouTube video, and basically everyone was trying to say, like, just apologize, like, say you made a mistake, and then if you want to go into a video and say like, this is what I do for a living, and so I apologize, I see the error in my ways, but I do want to go into culture or, you know, cancel culture and what it all means and all that. I don't think anyone would have had an issue with that, but she doubled down and then tripled down because there's all these tweets that are like, people jumping on Lindsay Ellis, you should really watch her whole video before you cast judgment. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to watch a 2 hour video in the hopes that at hour seven or a minute 79, she makes an apology for the horrible thing she did. And the reason I bring that up is because there's another author with a smaller platform, Kosoko Jackson, who was going to be on our podcast a few years ago. I think you were going to.
I interviewed him. Mm-hmm.
And Kosoko wrote, I want to make sure I get, do you remember the first book's name?
No. Hang on, let me look this up. I should. That was the one I interviewed him about. Okay,
that's all right. A Place for Wolves.
Place for Wolves, yes.
So there was another author, Kosoko Jackson, who Jill interviewed. He was going to be on the podcast a couple years ago. He wrote this book called A Place for Wolves. And A Place for Wolves was this book about a culture that he admittedly was not, I don't want to say unfamiliar with because he did the research, but I believe it was a book set in a Middle Eastern country. And he is not Middle Eastern. And it created this whole conversation about own voices and the fact that maybe he shouldn't be writing this book because it's not a story from his own like world to tell. It was set in the 1990s during the Kosovo War.
Right. It was like a very specific time in that part of the world that had nuance that he maybe nuance he couldn't know because that's just not his background.
Exactly. And so everyone was quick to go after him for this and attack him and be very angry about it. And as longtime listeners will know, Kosogo wasn't on that. We didn't ever air that episode because we didn't feel right. And the book ended up, Sourcebooks is the publisher. Sourcebooks ended up pulling it and now releasing it. So everyone kind of like went their separate ways and forgot about it. And then Kosogo has written a new book called Yesterday's History, which I believe actually just came out like this month. Or it's a recent release.
It's a recent release, I think. I don't remember for sure.
And it seems to be, I haven't read this one, but it seems to be much more positively reviewed and much more openly accepted. And it's one of those situations where he did something that was a mistake and he apologized for it and said, "This is okay, I see exactly what you all mean." And instead wrote a book that is kind of a story that he is more capable of telling. And this is like the way that the two responded couldn't be more different.
And I think, you know, Kosogo is actually just one example of reviewers, especially pre-pub reviews, do serve a purpose. That's why they're so important, is because, you know, like, and I think when it comes to this, like, quote unquote, cancel culture, which I don't like that phrase. It's more like consequence culture, but whatever. So
that's so much better. I love this.
I did not make that up. I stole it from somewhere. But, you know, in publishing and like, publishing is very white and things get missed no matter how many times you have. And even with, you know, an author of color, like, I mean, you know, Kosogo's Black, like, things will sometimes still get missed no matter how hard a publisher can try. And like, that's where pre-pub reviews can come in. And I feel like, you know, often it's the reviewers that sort of, when this happens and a book gets pulled or a book like gets permanently pulled and shelved or a book gets pulled for more edits, it's often the reviewers who are blamed for like pointing these things out, which is really not fair. Like, that's their job. Like, that's what they're there for. That is what those free pub reviews are specifically for. And I feel like people forget that, because I think people, whether it's other reviewers, whether it's fans, it's probably not other reviewers, whether it's fans of the author or authors themselves, you know, not getting those 5-star reviews. Yeah, it sucks, but like, that is what pre-pub reviews are for, is to sort of like put that book out into the world and get feedback, and things might need to be changed. And blaming reviewers for that sort of misses the whole point.
So sort of related to that, and we didn't mention this, like, we didn't say we're gonna talk about this before, but I just want your thoughts, and I can delete it if we don't want to keep talking about it. But like, over the weekend, I think, or maybe it was earlier this week, who knows time anymore? It's so confusing. But there was a book announced that is one by a man named Jonathan Mattingly that was involved in the Breonna Taylor death. And
that was so, last week. I'm with you now.
So, yep. So for reasons, like, there, it's very, we have our own opinions on that, but we won't get into that. But my question for you is, it can be really challenging because people saw that this book that a lot of people, and I agree with those people, don't think should exist and shouldn't be publicized and shouldn't be published, is being, in theory at the moment, you know, it was announced that it was going to be released under a publishing house that Simon & Schuster owns.
No. Simon & Schuster distributes. This is where some of the confusion happened, I think, in terms of like what Simon & Schuster's role is and how much. Now, obviously, we don't work for Simon & Schuster. I'm speaking entirely as someone who also has published books with that are distributed by Simon & Schuster. Like, if you go to Simon & Schuster, you can find my name because my books are distributed by them. But how it works is that smaller publishing houses who don't have the means to like print and get books into bookstores will sign with larger publishing houses. I think I don't know if all the publishing houses do this, but like Simon & Schuster obviously has this like arm of their business that is a distribution business. And so this smaller publisher, Post Hill Press, which from my understanding mostly airs on the side of like conservative type books, had signed this book and it was going to be distributed by Simon & Schuster. And people got upset at Simon & Schuster. I don't know. And like, I really don't know how much Simon & Schuster knows about what books are getting distributed by the smaller. I think people find that they're like, well, Simon & Schuster had to know, did they? Because they distribute a lot of books that aren't actually like published by Simon & Schuster. So I don't know how much Simon & Schuster knew. I feel like it's entirely possible that Simon & Schuster, that like the big head guys of Simon & Schuster may not have known that this small publisher that they distribute was going to sign, like was going to publish this book. I think that is entirely possible. Yeah. Like that seems feasible to me, but I don't work for them. So I don't know.
Well, so my question for you is, because exactly what you said, like, I think one of the things about publishing, it is so intricate and confusing and challenging to try to uncover. Even like if you find a book and you look up a press, like it can even be challenging to know who owns it. It can take a little bit of time and effort. But my question for you is, like, when that happened, there was an immediate like pushback where people were like, well, I'm done with Simon & Schuster. And like, first off, the thing is, you probably aren't, even if you don't realize it, just because there's really like the majority of the books are basically, it's a pyramid. It goes up to like, you know, one or two companies pretty at this much, point. Yeah. But my question for you, like, I feel like if you see a publisher doing something you disagree with, obviously, you know, voice your opinion any way that you want. But if you support authors who happen to be under their distribution or their publishing, like, I'm of the belief, like, I still want to support the authors that I believe in and that I like. And I know that it's not an easy answer, but like, do you have thoughts on like how to support people in those types of situations where, because the author, a lot of situations can't just break off from their contract. A lot of them don't have that type of power. Sure.
Yes. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Sorry. This was a really like challenging.
No. Yeah. No, I understand. A lot of authors don't have that choice to just be like, I'm going to pull my books from Simon & Schuster because there are contracts that are signed and that you can't just like, just do that. I mean, some will try, some will, some will try. If some is still in contract, if some hasn't been published yet, they may try and their book from that publisher and try to get it sold elsewhere. Yeah. I mean, but I'm not going to blame, because there are, yes, there are like four, I don't even know anymore. Like, there are five big publishers who all sort of that's it. And they all kind of flow upward from there because again, you have smaller publishers who get their books distributed by these publishers. And so I'm not going to blame an author. Right.
Yeah. That's kind of,
all right, here you go. So my publisher, Skyhorse, this is obviously information you can find, is distributed by Simon & Schuster. As you may recall, a while back, Woody Allen was trying to shop a memoir that nobody wanted. Guess who published it? My publisher. Yeah. I share a publisher with Woody Allen, y'all. I don't like this, but I can't do anything about it.
Right.
Like, my books are out there in the world. They publish my books. Like, that is a contract that I sign. And so,
And I guess, like, that was kind of my point. Is like, the way that I look at it, like, when I buy copies of your books, I'm purchasing them because I'm supporting Joe Grunewald, the author. Sure. I'm not purposely, like, there's no publisher that I go out of my way to be like, I'm going to buy books because Source Books publish.
Yes, correct.
Like, I just want to put people's minds at ease, because there can be so many things that are problematic about publishing and challenging to understand and get through. And I know that when there's so many readers that are very conscientious of these things and they want to do the right thing, but I just like support the authors by supporting their work any way you can, and maybe try to disassociate who's publishing and distributing them. Because to your point, you have no control over what, like, the your publisher isn't going to all the individual authors and being like, hey guys, we have someone we want to bring on, what are your thoughts?
Also, well, yeah, also because my books had been out, like, they had a different distributor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these things change, you know.
Yeah.
So it has not always been Simon and Schuster was distributing their books. Mm-hmm. And I think it should also be pointed out, I feel like our listeners probably don't need to be told this, but just in case, a publisher deciding not to publish your book is not censorship.
Thank you. Yes.
Just to put that out there, that's not censorship. Mm-hmm. That book can go get published somewhere else, or it doesn't. Nobody's owed a publishing contract, or you can self-publish. It's not censorship.
Yeah. Just
put that out there.
Yeah, there's nothing funnier than seeing a high-profile person go to get on a live, nationally syndicated show to talk about a thing, to talk about how they've they've been censored to the world. That's always a really fun thing to see happen.
It's not censorship. It's also, this is somewhat related, but it's also not censorship if an estate of a dead author who's behaved badly in prior books decides to stop publishing those books. That's also not censorship.
Yeah. Yeah. Another author who's, I got to stop getting tattoos.
You need to get stop getting literary tattoos.
Adam. It's on me, guys. It all starts with my body. We just want you to, like, we've been kind of, Jill and I slack about this stuff. And like, anytime one of these things comes up, we'll both just like, did you see the thing? And like, if we did it, then we'll link to what's the thing. Or one of us will say, did you see the thing that happened over the weekend with this person? And then there'll be like a 10 minute wait to response. And the other one will respond like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Cause clearly we were looking it up on Twitter. But yeah, we get pitches from authors every once in a while that it would be nice publicity to have them on our show, but we've said no because they are problematic.
Right. Yeah. This is sort of the challenge. You know, some of the authors, you know, as Adam said, had been on previously, and then this information comes out later.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been authors, big profile authors, who have been pitched to us, and we have said no because of various problematic things. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's one, and I will not name it because I don't want to, but there was one that is extremely buzzy right now. And I wasn't aware of the problems with them. And I was like, Joe, what do you think? And you,
and were, I'm like, no,
no, no. Like, hard line. No. And then you showed me
one hard line. No.
Oh, absolutely. So it's just something that, you know, normally we don't talk about a ton, but we think about it a lot and we have conversations about it internally. And we thought this would be a good time to address it. Are there other things you want to talk about here? I don't want to like just abruptly end, but
No, I think it's just, you know, I think it's a struggle when we've had authors on the podcast,
mm-hmm.
and then things come out later, like, what, I don't know what we do with those episodes, you know what I mean? Like, I know there were some other podcasts or other reviewers who were taking things down. Mm-hmm. we didn't discuss it either, but like, I don't know what the right answer is to that. So
yeah, so that's
all. And that's my only thing.
Yeah, no, that makes all the sense in the world. So yeah, if you guys liked this conversation, like, there are conversations that Jill and I have pretty frequently, so we could have more of them recorded if you enjoy them. We'll get back to giving you guys actual book recommendations. Next week will be May books. Oh my God.
Yes, it will.
So next week we'll preview all the books we're excited to read in May, and we'll get back to our regularly scheduled program. But yeah. Shoot us an email at professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. Let us know your thoughts. I'm really curious to see what you guys think about all this. Or tweets or Instagrams at ProBookNerds. But yeah, anything else you think people should know about?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Okay. All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of the Professional Book Nerds podcast.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Adam Sokol and Jill Grunewald, and presented by Overdrive. For more information, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.